First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
From OSHA to FLOSHA? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this Monday morning, we'll look at why Florida might try to secede from the federal agency that keeps you safe at work. What's this all about? Well, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the Jaguars lose again, this time to the Colts. Our Josh Torres has that depressing recap. All of that and much more ahead. But first this hour, could Florida actually make plans to secede from OSHA? The Occupational Safety and Health Administration is the federal agency charged with ensuring safe and healthful working conditions for America's workers. But Florida may soon appropriate about $1 million for the governor's office to develop a proposal to essentially secede us from federal oversight under OSHA. Specifically, the state would look into the possibility of adopting an OSHA state plan, an OSHA state-level agency. Now, the idea came out of last week's special legislative session where a number of bills were passed defying the Biden administration on vaccine mandates for large companies. A federal judge has already struck down one of them. We'll tell you about that in a moment. But first this hour, what would a FLOSHA look like? And is it even likely to happen? We're so pleased to have an expert. Jordan Barab served as the Deputy Assistant Director of OSHA from 2009 to 2017, and he's on the line. Jordan, good morning.
Good morning.
And folks, what are your questions about Florida looking to potentially secede from OSHA? What are your questions and concerns about workplace safety? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Your Facebook comments already coming in. Well, Jordan, let's first begin by explaining you were sort of a bigwig at OSHA for about a decade, so you know all about this agency, right?
I do know all about it. I've been working on OSHA and workplace safety issues for about 40 years.
Okay, so when you heard that Florida was looking to do this, to essentially pull out of oversight under OSHA, what was your first thought?
Well, my first thought was they had appropriated $1 million to do a study about this, and I was going to offer to give them the answer for about half that amount. basically, they can't really do that. They can adopt, certainly they can adopt a state OSHA plan if they want to, and if federal OSHA agrees, there are 21 states that have state plans. The problem is, you know, why does the governor want to do this? He wants to do it to get out from under OSHA's new standard that requires employers either to make sure their employees are vaccinated or that they're tested weekly. OSHA does not, by the way, have a vaccine mandate. It's a vaccine or test mandate. The problem with that is, with developing your own state plan, is that if a state wants to develop its own state plan, it also has to issue standards and enforce standards that are at least as effective as OSHA's, as federal OSHA's. At least as effective means that the state standard has to either be identical to federal OSHA's, or they can issue a stronger standard than federal OSHA's, but they're not allowed to issue a weaker standard, and they're not allowed to issue no standard. So even setting up its own state plan doesn't get Governor DeSantis out from under any OSHA standards.
Let us know your thoughts about this. 549-2937. So how have other states handled this? You say nearly two dozen other states have a state-level OSHA-like plan. Did they set those up for similar reasons, because they didn't like oversight from the feds?
Well, all of those state plans were set up either in the 1970s or, I think, one actually in the very early 1980s. And they did it for various reasons. Some of them, even before OSHA was created in 1970, had their own health and safety programs, and they wanted to, you know, they had the infrastructure, and they kind of wanted to continue with some control over that, so they adopted state plans. Some of them, yeah, did kind of want, figure they could, put a lighter hand on enforcement, I think, than the feds did, and they adopted them as well. So you have a real mix. I mean, you've got, you know, kind of, you know, liberal states like California, Oregon, Washington, and you've got other states like, you know, South Carolina, Kentucky and Tennessee that all have state plans.
Okay. And so let's say Florida goes through with this. Don't they have to ask the federal government for permission to set up such a scheme? What would OSHA likely say to Florida if this comes to pass?
Yeah, exactly. In order for a state to set up its state program, federal OSHA has to give it permission. And there are a number of requirements that the state has to fulfill in order to get federal OSHA to allow them to adopt a state plan. And when a state plan is adopted, then the feds fund half of it and the state funds half of it. But the state has to guarantee, first of all, again, that it issues standards that are at least as effective as OSHA's. It has to have a strong enforcement program that's at least as strong as federal OSHA's. It has to have a whistleblower kind of anti-retaliation program. It has to ensure federal OSHA that it's going to have enough funding that it's set up the entire bureaucracy to do that. And it actually, state programs have to cover public employees. It's a little known fact that public employees are not covered by federal OSHA. So the 24 states that don't have state plans do not cover public employees, including Florida. So if Florida set up its own program, it would not only have to cover private sector employees, it would also have to cover public sector employees under its OSHA program.
In the meantime, what should companies be planning on? Of course, the corporate sector doesn't like uncertainty. What should companies that have concerns about hazards in the workplace be thinking right now or planning right now? Nothing?
Well, it is a bit of a gray area here in terms of what they should be doing, because the standard for now has been stayed by the courts, at least by one one court in New Orleans, and it's going to be considered by another court very soon. I think in general, I think a lot of attorneys are recommending that employers actually do start complying with the standard. A lot of companies already are, as you may know. A lot of companies, especially large companies, already have vaccine mandates. United Airlines, for example, and a number of cities are also imposing vaccine mandates. OSHA standard is less than a mandate. Again, it either directs employers to establish a vaccine requirements or testing requirements. Public health-wise, it would be a good idea for all employers to do this. A lot of the legal experts think this OSHA standard is firmly grounded in OSHA's legal history, and that it will eventually be upheld, and that employers should, in fact, start taking measures to comply with it.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Jordan Barab. He served as the Deputy Assistant Director of OSHA from 2017. What are your thoughts about Florida looking to secede from OSHA, in effect? We'll go to your calls in a moment, 549-2937. Now, of course, this proposal came on the heels of a special legislative session, Jordan, where a number of bills were passed defying the federal government on vaccine requirements, safety requirements in the workplace. Over the weekend, a federal judge rejected Florida's request to block the Biden administration requirement that workers at hospitals, nursing homes, and other health care providers be vaccinated against COVID-19. So they did lose that round in court. As we continue to follow this, you've been writing that you think Florida will follow the path of another state, Arizona, and actually never go through with establishing a state OSHA plan. Why is that?
Well, Arizona is a different case. Arizona actually has a state plan, but Arizona, Arizona and two other states originally refused to adopt OSHA's last emergency temporary standard that just applied to healthcare workers.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay. Yeah.
Right. And federal OSHA basically said, you can't do that. As I said, you have to issue standards that are at least as effective as federal OSHA's. You cannot refuse to issue a standard. So federal OSHA sent letters to all three of those states threatening to revoke their state plans if they did not adopt the federal OSHA emergency temporary standard covering healthcare workers. Now, as far as I know now, I'm not sure exactly what's going on in all the states, but as far as I know right now, South Carolina has conceded. I'm not sure what's happening with Arizona and Utah. But Arizona, that you brought up, actually has a history of attempting to defy OSHA. When we were in office, Arizona said basically it wasn't going to enforce an OSHA fall protection standard for residential housing. And federal OSHA said, well, if you don't do that, we are going to come in and take over your construction sector. We're going to do enforcement in your construction sector. And there was a number of requirements to do that. It took about a year and a half, but just as federal OSHA got to the point where they were literally about to take over Arizona's construction sector, Arizona conceded and decided to adopt and enforce the residential fall protection standard. So if federal OSHA does not have much patience for states that defy the requirements about issuing standards that are at least as effective, and they will take action against those states. Mm. Now, at this point, of course, Florida doesn't have a state plan, so there's nothing Florida can do right now. Unless it establishes a state plan. And the other problem is, even if Florida did go ahead and decide to establish a state plan and federal OSHA said, all right, well, let's work on that, it takes years to do that, probably 3 or 4 years, because they have to set up, you know, they have to pass laws, they have to pass regulations, they have to set up the whole administrative bureaucracy, they have to hire people. It's a long process. And by the time Florida got to that point, hopefully COVID will be a distant memory.
Yeah, and of course, we'll already have been through another presidential election. That's the subtext to this, of course. Critics of these moves believe the governor puts these ideas out as a way to increase his national profile as he prepares to run for president. Lots of tweets, people having a little fun with this, a little OSHA humor this morning. Michael tweets the show, "This will be great. We can watch the Jaguars play without the burden of having to wear helmets," he says. Here is a tweet from Susie. "I can see it now. No more pesky hand washing by restaurant employees after they use the restroom. No more hard hats on construction sites. As my southern grandmother used to say, cut your nose off to spite your face." Okay, 549-2937 as we talk with Jordan Barab, former top official at OSHA. As Florida makes some noise about potentially getting out from under the thumb of OSHA, what would a FLOSHA look like? What are your questions? 549-2937. Eric in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. I think that we already settled this issue back in 1860. And the federal government at that point decided that the way in which people were being treated, laborers, was not right. And we had to change it. And now here we are 150, 160 years on, and leave it to the state of Florida, the last state to secede from or to surrender to the North, and forces here, the same wealthy forces that are here today as were back in those days, want to turn back the clock and to this draconian situation. Whenever we know this for a fact, every time we turn power over to the states wreck it. They wreck everything. I could go through a list, you know, as long as my arm. This is a bad idea. We need to get rid of Ron DeSantis and try to join the rest of the first world in how we treat people who work for a living. Thank you.
Eric, thank you. Okay, so Jordan, he referenced state versus federal power. That's a pretty deep divide in this country right now, particularly when it comes to this pandemic. Should states have the power to set these policies as opposed to the federal government bringing down mandates in the workplace, which is what this is all about, what this whole argument is about?
Yeah, well, in addition to 1860, in 1970, the Occupational Safety and Health Act was passed by Congress and signed by President Nixon to set federal standards, in other words, a federal floor to all OSHA standards and enforcement. And the reason they did this was because, you know, before that, states just did their own thing or did nothing. So what you had was basically what they call a race to the bottom. And in races to the bottom, you know, workers always come in last. Because what you have is, you know, one state may say, all right, we're going to set standards, and the state next door may say, well, we're going to attract business by setting, you know, looser standards. And the state next door to that may say, well, you know, we're not going to lose out to those two states, so we're going to set even weaker standards. So you have, again, a race to the bottom where every state is trying to basically set looser standards than the state next door. And again, workers lose. Workers are the ones that, as a result of that race to the bottom, are getting injured and killed in the workplace. So OSHA was established exactly to make sure there was a floor so that, you know, that states couldn't race to the bottom, that every state would have a minimum minimum standards and minimum enforcement. And the federal government allowed states to, you know, to have their state plans if they wanted to set stronger standards. And in fact, we've seen some states like California and a few other states actually set stronger standards. Virginia was the first state to have a permanent COVID standard, for example, way before OSHA had its standard.
Melissa tweets the show, I work for a battery manufacturer here in North Florida. They were poisoning us until an employee called OSHA with serious concerns. If it wasn't for OSHA, that company would still be poisoning its employees. The company didn't want to spend the money for safety measures. Tom on Facebook says, Florida is already a right-to-work state, which limits workers' rights. A Florida OSHA would simply add the right to die or be injured to our workers' rights. Okay, here's a tweet from Jim. I'm pretty sure that workers' compensation insurance carriers would disagree with all of this. Can you talk a little bit, Jordan, about how workers' comp would be affected if the state were to follow through?
Yeah, workers' comp probably wouldn't be affected that much. It's a separate system. You know, workers' comp was set up in the early 20th century to more or less guarantee compensation for workers who were hurt on the job. It doesn't work very well. It doesn't really provide adequate benefits for workers who are injured on the job. And it does a terrible job when it comes to workplace illness because, you know, employers will, in the example of COVID, the employers, for example, might argue that, well, hey, he got COVID, you know, from his spouse at home, not on the job. So there's always a fight about occupational illnesses and workers' comp. But OSHA is a separate system. You know, workers' comp only kicks in after a worker gets injured or sick. The point of OSHA, the main goal of OSHA, is to prevent those kind of injuries, illnesses, and deaths from happening in the first place.
Of course. John in St. Augustine emails the show, I can't believe we have to pay for this. As I mentioned, there will be $1 million set aside to study the issue. The same with all of these lawsuits in the recent past and over the Florida school districts that implemented a mask mandate. We, the taxpayers, are paying for this. Also, what federal dollars will Florida lose once we leave OSHA, he asks.
Right. Well, again, yeah, it is a bunch of smoke and mirrors because the answer is fairly obvious. Again, in 10 minutes, you know, one can read the Occupational Safety and Health Act and the associated regulations and realize that this isn't going to work. I'm sorry, what was the second question?
Mm-hmm. He thinks that the state could lose federal dollars if we were to leave oversight.
Well, the state isn't going to lose federal dollars from OSHA. Now, there are, you know, the other requirements that you mentioned. These are the requirements for hospitals that are put out by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that require all healthcare facilities that accept Medicare and Medicaid funding must issue a vaccine mandate. I mean, a real mandate, and all employees in those facilities have to be vaccinated. If they don't do that, then, of course, the federal government has the option of pulling Medicare and Medicaid funds from those hospitals and healthcare institutions.
So then I would encourage everyone to read your blog about this, Jordan, where you go into a lot more detail. But it sounds as though you believe this is a lot of sound and fury signifying not much, that nothing really will come to pass in the end from all of this. Is that your position?
Yeah, I mean, as you indicate, it's more or less kind of a campaign issue for Governor DeSantis. It's not going to work. I mean, if a state goes to OSHA and says, we want to set up our own state program so we can issue weaker standards than you all do, federal OSHA is going to laugh them out of the room. It's just not going to work. It's not even going to get started. And again, if the state does adopt the program, they have to issue the same standards anyway. So this is not a route. This is not a way to get out from under complying with federal OSHA standards.
We'll follow it. In the meantime, it's great to get your insights. Jordan Barab, he served as the Deputy Assistant Director of OSHA from 2009 to 2017. More about this on our website, too, at wjct.org. Jordan, have a great Thanksgiving, and thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And much more still ahead later in the hour. The Jags lose again. The Gators tell their coach to get lost. But up next.
ECMO is an acronym for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. What it essentially is an artificial heart or an artificial lung, depending on the case, for patients who have refractory heart failure or refractory lung failure.
The life-saving technology for the sickest COVID patients and where it's being offered. A look at ECMO next.
Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT Public Media is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, profiles of local artists, and more. Turn your ear on the beautiful noise emerging from Northeast Florida and learn more about the local artist whose music is reverberating across the country. Visit jacksmusic.org to play it local and play it loud.
Welcome back. Well, for COVID patients, it's a vital technology that literally keeps them alive when nothing else works. ECMO, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, treats severe heart or lung failure, or both, the kind that doesn't respond to typical medical treatment. It essentially takes over the heart and lung functions for a seriously ill COVID patient. ECMO doesn't treat the disease itself. It just supports the body while it fights off the disease. The goal of ECMO is to increase oxygen delivery to the body and remove carbon dioxide while the heart and the lungs recover. Now, there's now a new ECMO machine at Memorial Hospital in Jacksonville to help the sickest COVID patients. I learned more from Dale Muller, MD. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon at Memorial. Here's that conversation. Dr. Muller, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having me on First Coast Connect.
Sure. So tell us, what is ECMO and why is this such a big deal for local patients, particularly your COVID patients?
So ECMO is an acronym for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. What it essentially is an artificial heart or an artificial lung, depending on the case, for patients who have refractory heart failure or refractory lung failure. And why it's so important is because we have a significant number of those patients, even before COVID. When COVID came about, there was a pretty huge deficit of the number of ECMO machines we had available. And hence, Memorial thought that there was a need in the community for such devices to allow to take care of those patients who had COVID that was refractory to other treatments.
Right. We've heard these incredible tales of patients with really serious disease scouring the country for hospitals, healthcare facilities that have this technology. And it's been hard to find. There's been such a demand for it, and not everyone who's sick has been able to get on these machines. Is that right?
That's correct. I remember an occasion where there was a patient in Jacksonville, and that patient actually went to a friend and colleague of mine in Tennessee because we had no availability for ECMO. It's been very unfortunate, but fortunately the ECMO community has responded as best they could in unforeseen circumstances, obviously.
And so how does this impact the local picture, the lay of the land in Jacksonville for the treatment of COVID?
Sure. Well, you know, it depends if COVID, you know, what happens with COVID in the future, of course. But there was a need before this, and there will always be a need for this technology. And what it allows now is for us to maintain patients locally within the community to provide this service for them, where they don't have to be looking for such a service outside, even in Florida or even outside Florida under some circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, at some waves in the pandemic, people were sending patients out of state. We'd heard a lot about this over the months. And it's my understanding you've got to do some intensive training at the hospital for ECMO among various departments. This is a pretty elaborate effort.
It is. I came from Illinois, and we had a very large ECMO program in Illinois. I've been here for 4 years, so I was trained much before this. But that included, you know, retraining by myself because I've been here for 4 years. And then also all the other physicians, all the other respiratory therapists, all the nurses, all the staff got both trained in the classroom. Then there's a very large book that you have to read of over 500 pages. And then we've had multiple meetings, multiple sessions where we practiced various drills of putting people on ECMO, taking people off ECMO, and the management for those patients. So it's been many hours and a lot of effort to allow these patients to receive such technology.
Now, this can only be prescribed. You want physicians in the area to know that this technology is available so patients can get treated locally. Tell us about that.
Well, we want to become the provider of ECMO in northeastern Florida. It's a service that has to be sought out by another physician, and we have a number that can be reached that contacts me directly, and we'll accept those patients as need be. But we want to provide the service so people don't have to go outside the community. We're very excited about this technology. I'm passionate about this technology because it does work. There are circumstances unfortunate for patients who, you know, otherwise would not survive without ECMO, but yet with ECMO, with COVID, they are offered a good survival rate, a reasonable survival rate. Without it, the prognosis is dismal, unfortunately.
Thanks so much for this. He's Dale Mueller, MD, cardiothoracic surgeon at Jacksonville's Memorial Hospital. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, she's the city's first ever chief resilience officer charged with shoring up Jacksonville's defenses to the coming impacts of climate change. I learned more about her big goals for this position when I spoke with CRO Ann Colianese. Take a listen.
Hi, Ann. Good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of interest in you around town. You're the first person ever to serve as the city's chief resilience officer. Tell us about what it's been like for you in these initial months as you get settled into the role.
It's been really great so far. I don't know of any other person who's stepped into a chief resilience officer role in another city with this level of enthusiasm and excitement for this work. It really seems like across the board, from the administration to the city council to nonprofits, everyone's really, really ready for resilient solutions and excited to get to work and start making changes. So for me coming in, that's just kind of the best possible landscape to have landed in.
Sure. And of course, Jacksonville had been criticized for being really behind the eight ball on this. Other Florida cities have had this kind of position for a while now because we do face such impacts from climate change. Sea level rise, water rise inland, more extreme storms, all kinds of negative impacts. So tell us a little bit about your top priorities and how you plan to help Jacksonville better mitigate against what we expect to be happening here.
Well, one thing I'll say is that even though this is the first time Jacksonville's had a CRO, there has been a lot of resilience work underway for years. And so that puts me in a really good position to hit the ground running on things. For example, the city's planning department stood up the Adaptation Action Area Work Group to look at how are we mapping our high-hazard coastal areas. The Public Works Department has been working on a model for a vulnerability assessment, things that we're able to scale up and serve as kind of a baseline for me and my work. So I think coming in, a lot of groundwork's been laid. So the direction I'm hoping to take it is pulling together kind of that baseline science and data, layering it on top of community priorities, economic and social priorities, and then come up with a suite of interventions that can really address risk here in Jacksonville. And those interventions could be at the policy level. Many of them I expect to be physical infrastructure projects, and others might be more programmatic. If we're putting in more green infrastructure, do we need a workforce development program that trains people in how to build green infrastructure so that we make sure we can capture kind of that economic benefit of these solutions? So that's the direction I'm hoping to take it, and have kind of a comprehensive resilience strategy where all of those resilience interventions are housed and easily communicated to the public.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You were chosen to lead Jacksonville's resilience effort out of candidates from across the country. You come at this with a deep bench of experience, including at the federal level. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I came here from the city of New Orleans, where I was running their coastal resilience program, looking at how sea level rise and coastal land loss increased New Orleans risk and finding nature-based solutions to address that, and really got a deep dive into one of the most vulnerable parts of the country and parts of the world with respect to hurricane risk. And then pairing that with kind of a federal background, I've had the fortunate opportunity to work with pretty much every federal agency and have insight into how they're baking in climate change into not only their internal operations, but also the way that they run their grant programs and other programmatic elements. So seeing it from that high level and then seeing that hyper-local on-the-ground experience in New Orleans, I'm hoping to bridge those two together and really have the broadest possible lens for Jacksonville and use a lot of the best practices that I've seen nationally and then also from my personal background in New Orleans. And I hope that that'll be a really big asset to this work and make sure that we're not reinventing the wheel, where we're really building off of some of the best practices that are being done across the nation.
Now, the impacts of climate change tend to affect people of color and low-income communities more harshly. What do you think the city should be doing to address this problem?
I think when you look at things like who's getting flooded, who's having problems with urban heat, you absolutely can see those parallels to communities of color and low-income or vulnerable communities. So naturally, if we're looking at this either from a social perspective or just from the raw scientific data, both avenues are going to lead us to the same outcome, which is that those are communities that are going to need an increase in green infrastructure projects, increase in tree canopy that can address both flooding and reduce heat. So I think that is going to be a huge target area for this work. And I absolutely expect that equity will be central to how I move forward with shaping the city's resilience.
And how do you deal with people who still are sort of in denial about this? They don't believe climate change is real, or they've accepted that it's real, but they just don't think it's a serious problem.
I think at this point, the science is very clear, and it matters less if an individual personally believes that because their insurance company is going to believe
that.
Yeah,
right.
We're seeing markets change. And so this is, if you can, one, see the water rising. We can see the difference in summer rainstorms that are hitting a city like Jacksonville now versus 10 years ago. There's just more water. And if that isn't enough to kind of turn your perspective on this, certainly some of those financial and market-based measures are going to be a big indicator that this is, in fact, happening. And I also think that's a huge motivation behind this administration to really address this as quickly as possible, because if not, we could be, you know, setting ourselves up for an even worse situation. So really that financial and risk is a huge foundation for why we have to act on climate and why we have to act now.
And, of course, time is of the essence. You are working with a number of stakeholders on an overall strategy, a vulnerability assessment for the city, and a strategy. When do you think we might be seeing more details about that?
Well, I think it's most important that we get it right. So certainly there's, we want to get this on the ground as quickly as possible, but we also want to make sure that, we're careful enough and intentional enough in how we're rolling out resilience, that it's done right. Because if it's not, then we would hate for this to be a short-term fix. We really want this to be something that not only lasts for the next 5 years, but also the next 25 years. And so I think much of the next year will be incorporating these different planning elements, whether that's the vulnerability assessment and the technical data, or broad-based stakeholder engagement, and kind of pulling those things together and setting our goals and identifying projects. But the hope is that even during that time, while this planning work is going on, there are things we can do, making use of the city's tree mitigation fund, trying to get as much tree canopy as we can, as quickly as we can. Those are things that we don't have to necessarily wait on. But when we're thinking about large pieces of new infrastructure that might be needed to address the impacts of climate change, there you really want to make sure the science is behind you. And that does just inherently take a bit more time.
Well, I appreciate your time, and we look forward to speaking with you again soon. She's Anne Colonisi, the first ever Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Jacksonville. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, there's a dazzling new exhibit at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Botanical Gardens this holiday season, and you need to go see it. Colna Smith is Chief Creative Officer for the Memoir Agency. They helped bring this dazzling night's exhibit to life. Cole, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. You know, I've heard raves about this exhibit at the Arboretum and Gardens. I've seen pictures on Instagram. People can't stop talking about it. It sounds amazing. So tell us all about this.
Well, I can't take all the credit because the Arboretum is just an incredible place to begin with. And its beauty is brought to life in a brand new way at night as we light up the Arboretum with large-scale lighting installations all throughout the park over about a three-quarter mile walkthrough experience.
Okay, so describe, if you could, paint a picture in our minds what this looks like, what people will see when they go to the Arboretum and they go into this magical holiday wonderland.
Well, the experience starts as you drive down the road that leads up to the Arboretum, and you'll see these massive oak trees that are just such a beautiful part of our Florida natural environment, illuminated in bright light and color. And as you arrive at the gardens, the first experience as you walk over a bridge, there's a foggy zone coming up from under the bridge and bright, beautiful light moving through the fog. And as you turn the corner, you'll turn the corner to tens of thousands of red, blue, and purple twinkling lights hanging from the trees overhead. And then as you continue forward, there's some fun interactive experiences like some pads that are installed in the ground, and when guests walk over those, they light up.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun. Kind of, you'll see kids skipping over them and kids at heart skipping over them too. A long 65-foot light tunnel, and that's just the first couple experiences.
Yeah, there's even more. The interactive bits, I think people are especially excited about. Now, what environmental considerations were taken? This is a natural space. Were you concerned at all about light pollution or nocturnal birds or electric fires and that kind of thing?
We work hand in hand with the partners of the Arboretum, and the Arboretum is actually just one of several locations for this. And one of the things that our company really cares about is making sure that we minimize the impact on the natural environment as much as possible. Of course, it does bring more people through the Arboretum, which is wonderful because it introduces a lot of guests to the Arboretum for the first time. But there's also that guest impact. And so we're making sure that people stay on trails that are designated with specific, you know, lights and those kinds of things. And then we make sure that we're shutting down all of that light as the night ends so that those natural animals that exist in the dark can live in peace mm-hmm. throughout the evening.
Now, your firm, the Memoir Agency, has done this kind of work in other places in Florida. So you guys are sort of experts at this, right?
you know, we love creating meaningful experiences, and we get the opportunity to do that. We're from Orlando and got to do a Dazzling Nights experience here last year. And one of the things that we love is creating events that people can come to, make an annual tradition, and experience something with the people they love that they can make memories that will last a long time.
With all of that said, I do really recommend people come out to this. You will not be sorry. You know, folks, think about how you go and drive around town and look at all the Christmas decorations, particularly this little stretch up along Girvan Road, which is a really famous neighborhood that really does it up big for the holidays. Well, this is like that, but even bigger and in a beautiful outdoor space. You know, Cole, for people that have never been to the Arboretum, they really should come out because it is a unique spot right in the middle of the city.
Yeah, the Arboretum itself, just going during the daytime, which I hope so many of our guests who come maybe to Dazzling Nights at night for the first time will come back and visit the Arboretum during the day because it really is spectacular. And at night, just a small portion of the 120-acre property is activated. And so we really hope guests will come back and experience the beautiful asset that the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens are to the city of Jacksonville.
We are speaking with Colna Smith, Chief Creative Officer for the Memoir Agency. They helped create Dazzling Nights this holiday season at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens. Now, the Arboretum is located at 1445 Milco Road in Jacksonville. If you've never been, you need to head over and check this out. Cole, how can people come out and enjoy the light exhibit?
All the information is at dazzlingjacks.com. We have made sure that guests can have the best experience possible by limiting audience sizes at particular times, and so people can see the dates and times there. The event is currently running. We opened last Friday, and we run through January 9th.
Yes, and as I said, several of my friends and coworkers have already gone, and I've checked out their Instagram posts. I missed the preview, so I am definitely going to make a point of getting over and seeing this during the holiday season with my family, because I think it's just so special, and the Arboretum is one of those really special local places that everyone should come check out. It's this oasis, this urban oasis, this gorgeous natural space in the middle of a very busy city. So check out a million lights at Dazzling Nights at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens up now through January 9th. And he is Colna Smith, Chief Creative Officer for the Memoir Agency in Orlando, who created this exciting, dazzling holiday display. Have a great holiday, Cole, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Okay. In a moment, some sports. The Jaguars lose again. And there's more sports news and notes to talk about. It's all coming up. Don't go away.
Encore Research Group sites are enrolling in research studies for conditions such as Alzheimer's disease, heart disease, high cholesterol, and more. Insurance is not required to participate. More information is available at EncoreDocs.com. FarmShare, working to provide food for the 3.9 million Floridians who don't know where they will receive their next meal this holiday season. Those who wish to help or learn more about how FarmShare fights food insecurity in Florida can visit farmshare.org/holidays.
Spanish settlers and Tomuqua Indians shared a meal of Thanksgiving in Florida 55 years before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the real first Thanksgiving. We'll talk about suffragist Mary Nolan and the map collection of Tom Touchton. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, an inside look at the American gun industry and its alliance with the National Rifle Association. Ryan Bussey spent years marketing firearms, but says he couldn't stomach the industry's embrace of assault weapons and its willingness to stoke fear and hatred to sell them. His new book is called Gunfight. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Calls continue to grow for the man who presided over the Rittenhouse murder case to be removed. Now in his 70s, Bruce Schroeder is the longest-serving current judge in Wisconsin. But his behavior during the trial threw a spotlight on both himself and on how we appoint and elect judges across the country. That story and the latest from Kenosha, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Jaguars lost yet again. Josh Torres was in the press box and has a recap as well as some other sports news and notes. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Melissa.
Okay, so the Jags lose to the Colts away. They come home to play San Francisco. You know, I saw a lot of red jerseys coming out of that stadium after it was over, and the 49ers fans were pretty happy.
Oh, yes, they were. Yeah, the Jags lost last week. Heartbreaking loss, had a chance to win it, unfortunately didn't work out. You know, that usually that's your chance to try and come home, get a big win against a pretty decent opponent, and boy oh boy, did the Jags not do that. Melissa, to say that they got outplayed is an understatement. The first drive for San Francisco in the opening quarter lasted 13 minutes. Just constant penalties that were keeping the offense off of the field. Defense had to stay on there till they basically almost couldn't play. And this was just, I mean, nothing was right yesterday. Rayshon Jenkins, a defensive captain, got kicked out of the game early on for throwing a punch at a San Francisco player. Constant penalties that were extending San Francisco drives. Offense just could not get anything going. The only touchdown they scored was in the during the fourth quarter towards the end of the game off of James Robinson 1 yard rush, and it really, honestly, even after the game, the team knew had they played bad. This is the first time I've really seen Urban Meyer, Trevor Lawrence, all of them just look defeated, where they really understood we did not play well anywhere today. I honestly, it's almost
pretty
hard to
depressing.
Explain. And it showed, like you said, yesterday, when by the end of the game, by halfway through the fourth quarter, the only people left in the stadium were San Francisco fans. And they were, I mean, you look over on the San Francisco sideline, they're all jumping around because they know they basically just kicked all the Jags fans out of the stadium, and now this is their stadium. And it was really a sad sight to see. And this week, the team is back at TIA Bank Field to play the Atlanta Falcons. And oh boy, it's going to be, I don't expect to see a lot of Jags fans after yesterday. I've seen nothing but extreme frustration from Jags fans.
And will Urban Meyer even make it much longer?
That is one of the biggest questions, is how much longer really until the Jags just have to suck it up and let him go. But one of the questions is, who do they put in his place?
They're just limping to the end of their season, though. It's pretty depressing to watch. Okay, let's talk college football. UF lost yesterday, and UF did pull the plug on their coach, Dan Mullen.
Yep, UF lost on Saturday night to Missouri, 24-23 in overtime. It's their fourth loss in five games, and after a lot of speculation over the last few weeks, UF did pull the plug on Dan Mullen. He's really struggled during his tenure there to get them a big win, especially against Power 5 opponents. Last year, they went all the way to the SEC championship game, and now they're fighting just to be bowl eligible. Speaking of bowl eligibility, they're actually playing FSU in the big UF-FSU rivalry game. FSU won on Saturday against Boston College 26-23. That means that this weekend's game, UF-FSU, is going to be for a bowl game. Both teams need one win to be bowl eligible and to try and get a bowl invitation and avoid a losing record. Fun fact, this is the first time since 1961 that both teams are entering this game with a losing record. So this is a huge game for both teams. Continuing with our college football, Georgia, nothing needs to be said, dominated Charleston Southern 56-7. They're gearing up for a trip to the SEC championship game. Miami pulled out a big win against Virginia Tech 38-26. Now they are eligible for a bowl game, so that is looking good for the Hurricanes. And UCF, I had one of our listeners ask me to talk a little UCF football. Guys, I listened to you. UCF won their game against Connecticut 49-17. They improved to 7-4 on their year.
Yeah, the UCF fans are out there, and they are listening to your wrap-up every Monday, Josh. So thanks for adding that in. Okay, a little bit more. You want to talk about UNF men's basketball, too, and
yep,
JU?
Yep, I want to talk a little college basketball for our local teams. UNF, again, they always start their season off with some really tough matchups. They had to go against the number two ranked team in the country, so they actually lost their first five matchups, but they finally pulled out their first win of the year against Weber International for their home opener and actually tied for the program's record for 3 points made at 22. Great game for the Ospreys men. Then JU's men's team, they won their first two games, and then actually just lost to UCF 63-54 this past weekend. JU's women's team won their first two matchups, but did lose their third game to FSU, and they're starting their season 2-1. Last thing I want to talk about, UNF women's basketball. They're off to their best record since they became a Division I team. 5-1, only game they've lost is to FSU.
Huh.
So a lot of great basketball being played here in Jacksonville.
Go Ospreys. And thanks, as always, for your Monday sports recaps. By the way, I heard the ice cream machine at TIAA Bankfield was working this weekend.
It was working for about 5 minutes, just enough time for a few people to get in there and get some ice cream, and it broke, and we all joke that that was just the epitome,
a metaphor
for what was going on the field.
Tales from the Press Box. Josh Torres, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so much, everyone. Thanks also to Senior Producer Heather Schatz, Director Josh Torres, Associate Producer Catherine Hobbs, along with Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo, News Editor Randy Rogusky, and the entire WJCT News team. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for one more show before the Thanksgiving holiday. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.